everyone, please, if you would open up to the book of Job. We're going to be considering that great man from the Old Testament here this evening is the third of our series on great people of the Bible. Here, of course, on the screen is one artist's depiction of the scene that is taking place throughout the great majority of the book, which is poor Job, who has lost everything that can possibly be precious in life. In every sense, he has lost it all. And there he is now in terrible pain, emotionally and physically, and three friends gather ostensibly to bring him comfort, and they do nothing of the kind. And so we'll unfold a total of 42 chapters in which the great discussion about why there is suffering in the world, how to reconcile it with a kind and loving God, unfolds over the course of some 42 chapters. So we'll be looking at Job not only tonight, but again next week. There's just such a tremendous amount of information to consider there. Before we get into the book itself, though, I've been, of course, gearing up for the chronological Bible study, using the chronological study Bible, which will begin next Wednesday night. The books did come in. Now, please do not pick one up tonight. You have decided to wait until next Wednesday. But here we will get started next Wednesday there. I might just point out, I keep showing this photograph, and I was laughing because when the books finally came in, they're actually a leather-bound book. They don't look much like this at all. Okay, so we get a different cover anyway. But really a nice book, very high-quality book that we'll be working with. But Job is a very difficult book, well, an impossible book, to place in time. He does not tell us in any way what the time frame is. There's no references to kings. There's no references to any other biblical figure. There's no reference to anything that can help us identify when he wrote the book. So there's actually about three different places where people suspect that perhaps there's evidence in the book to give us an idea of where he is. In the chronological study Bible, they're going to put him about 1000 B.C., they place Job's writing there right after the book of Proverbs and simply link it to what we call the five books of wisdom literature. And so there you'll find it in your chronological Bible, almost dead center, in fact, just a little bit ahead of the center of the book. I've always thought, and rather would vote, that he was living about 1,000 years earlier than that, the previous to the time of Abraham, which is most likely somewhere in the bracket around 1900 years before Christ. So it gives you some idea of just how widespread the suggestions are as to when he was writing. Now, I realize, of course, you can't read this print, it's entirely too small. If you go online, you'll be able to find a number of different timelines that will help you place Bible books into history. Chronological Study Bible is an outstanding job arranging the Bible books where we have clues. You know, most of them will give us an idea of where they fit. Job's something of an exception there. But if we zoom in on this chart, I easily found online, very high quality, and you'll be able to do the same thing. You know, look at it in some detail if you go online. Just Google Bible timeline and under images, and it'll pop up. We're going to zoom into just this section right here, and hopefully there you can read some of that. But what they're doing on this chart is illustrating the length of each of the Bible characters in the early chapters of the book of Genesis by showing verses, of course, where they're referenced. But also this number right here is how long they lived. So here's Methuselah, for instance, 969 years. Lamech, his son, was 777 years. Noah up there, who we considered last week, lives 950. So he's actually really close to Methuselah. His grandfather got him beat by a little bit, but not by a whole lot. And then, of course, we have Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and then descendants from there. But this chart, for instance, just illustrates immediately how different it was before the flood and after the flood. Noah is the great hinge on Bible history between pre-flood and post-flood. Before the flood, huge lengths of time, and nearly a millennium for a couple of them. 910 years, 895, 962, 969, 777, 950. That's a long time to live.
But Noah's on the ark and with his sons, and when we get off the ark, Shem, 600, that's 350 fewer years than his dad. He only lived about two-thirds as long as his dad did. Arphaxad drops to 438, 433, 464. And before you know it, we're getting all the way down into fairly normal times of today. And on this particular chart, and again, I don't have an answer for that. I don't know why God chose to do that. The effects of sin is just degrading the world, whatever that may be. God did say that, you know, normal lifespan is about 70 years. And so after these days, that is what he had decreed. But you'll see on this chart, they're placing Job right here, which would fall between Abraham and Moses. Some would suggest that Job ought to be moved a couple of hundred years and over here closer to Moses, even during the lifetime of Moses. And then the Chronological Study Bible places it even farther back. And all I'm suggesting here is that Job, at least, you know, another likely candidate, was to live right here just prior to Abraham, which would put him loosely about 2,000 years before Christ. Job, perhaps, lived 2,000 years before Christ. We are living 2,000 years after Christ. This great question about why there is such suffering and do we deserve to be treated like this is, of course, a timeless and ageless question. So that's one of the reasons, in fact, I think it was probably written sooner, is that this is the common experience of humankind. And we all of us have to deal with it. There have been no exceptions. So I'm suspecting that God probably addressed this topic at such great length as he did, you know, earlier on in world history for the sake of all of our comfort. Now, as we're going to approach Job, though, remember last week we were talking about Noah. Oh, that reminds me of these movies that get things so inaccurate all the time. I saw a movie here not too long ago, and it showed Jonah coming off the ark and speaking with God in the burning bush. And now I'm doing something similar. But anyway, last week we were talking about Noah, when centuries after he had lived, Ezekiel said, if a country sins against me, Ezekiel, of course, is speaking for God, if a country sins against God, by committing unfaithfulness, and I stretch out my hand against it. See, remembering this as we're reading the book of Job, God stretching out his hand against a country because of its sins, and destroys its supply of bread, sends famine against it, cuts off from it both man and beast, even though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in its midst, by their own righteousness, they could only deliver themselves, declares the Lord God. Now, in all the Bible, and this will be repeated a little bit later in Ezekiel chapter 14, but you know, we have three times, actually, where these statements are made, and we have individuals singled out, Noah, Daniel, and Job, for their what? For their righteousness. These guys did it right. These men were so well-pleasing in the sight of God that he references them for centuries as the perfect examples of righteousness, of being what God wants us to be. Does that mean that they never committed a sin? No, it doesn't mean that. But it does mean that when they, in their frailty and weakness, did commit a sin, they handled it properly. And that by and large, they were so devoted to the service of their God that they were free from sin the majority of the time. And they become also then perfect examples of righteousness for you and for me, so that we can practice what they did and be as well-pleasing in God's sight as they were. So, you've heard of the book of Job now. Let's remember the first and the last things that are said about Job in his book. Verse 1, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil.
It'd be an odd thing to say if you were writing the book yourself. And so some suggest that maybe some other author is recording what took place here. Be that as it may, it doesn't matter. When God inspires one to write, they can write about themselves. And so I rather think Job wrote the book himself. It would have been embarrassing for him, I suppose. But this man is introduced at the start of this book as what? He is four things. He is blameless. Now, brethren, suppose the elders next week, what we really need is somebody in the congregation who we can use in our advertising for the congregation here throughout all Eugene, you know, as being a blameless member of the church. Who should we pick? How about David Craig? Stand up. You're blameless. Okay, we all would just shrink. Say, whoa, you know, that's not me. Well, how about upright? We need an example of an upright individual. Brother, I'm hoping we have some more candidates. There's always one in the congregation, you know of whom I speak, who's willing to volunteer for everything. Good to hear it. And that's the way it ought to be. Brother, is it wrong to say that you as an individual are an upright person? It's another way of saying stand-up kind of guy. Okay. Well, yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. And quite a few of us ought to be able to lay claim to that. Fearing God. How many of us in the room would say, well, okay, you know, you could use me as an example of one who fears God. You know, hopefully by the time we get there, we're all raising our hands, you know, and it's not pride or arrogance, but it is a way of life, and it is my conviction and my commitment. It's what I'm trying to be, is an individual that reveres, respects, that obeys because I fear the power of my God and the judgment of my God. We're all trying to do that. And certainly the last one, the fourth of these, we also could claim. We are attempting to turn away from evil. We're trying to avoid that thing. This is how Job is represented by God, who wants his book to be read for centuries and millenniums. He is the perfect representation of righteousness. Now see how the book ends. There are 42 chapters in Job. As we come to the conclusion of this book, then verses 7 and 8, it's right in the middle of a short chapter, at the end. It came about after the Lord had spoken these words to Job, that the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, "My wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends, because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has." Now, brethren, we're not going to study the whole book. You're going to read the whole book about 9 months from now, you know, in the Chronological Study Bible. But let's remember that while we can't take the time to read the whole book, at the end of this book, God says these words that he's recorded for us, maybe 4,000 years now, these words were right. What Job said was right. Now, he got rebuked by God. He got set in his place by God. He's not a perfect man. He made some mistakes. But by and large, God's overview of the way he represented himself, and especially how he represented his God, was right. And consequently, the book of Job, brethren, my conviction at least, has been used properly by the great majority of Christians, you know, for centuries, since there's been Christianity, millenniums, since Job wrote the book, very properly, as a great insight and help when we're suffering. What is the book of Job about? Suffering. Everybody answers that question the same way. But brethren, tonight and next week, what we're going to do in this time slot is to recognize that that's not the only purpose of the book. Job was the perfect example of righteousness. The things he said are ultimately wise and insightful and helpful for dealing with life's problems. And as we go through the book, you'll also discover not just the problem of, well, you know, I have migraine headaches that are debilitating. My mom has such headaches. Or I've got diabetes, we've been hearing about with Ann's son. Or I've got cancer, or I've got this or that another thing, or I can't
find work. You know, the economy is destroying me. I've lost my home because I've lost my job, and now I've lost my car, and I can't even get around, and how am I going to get a job? And, you know, whatever life's travails are, that's not the only purpose of the book. It is also to show you what a righteous person is, and particularly how they think.
Not everything that Job says is just about my body hurts and I lost everything, you know, my kids are dead, you know, it's just been a terrible disaster, and so I'm dealing with that in particular. Great deal more than that. 42 chapters. And brethren, if I'm right in my placement of when Job lived, did Job live before or after Moses?
Before. Two out of three possibilities are before Moses. And if that's the case, and Job lived before Moses wrote about creation, Job lived before Moses lived, and even before Abraham lived, who, thank you, Nolan, there it is,
you know, read from Genesis 12 this evening. Now, I asked him to read Genesis 12. Here's Abraham, and we'll be looking at him in the third week from now, after 2 weeks with Noah. But probably during Abraham's lifetime or just before is where this most blameless, upright, righteous, and wise man conducted his affairs in this life. So as we go through, excuse me, remember God's judgment of him. Now, we'll have to go rather quickly, though, as I've said, going to have 2 weeks because there's just so much to see. So, back to chapter 1, we'll just be going along, you know, chapter after chapter, you can follow there. In verses 2 through 5, he had 7 sons, he had 3 daughters, he had 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels and 500 yoke of oxen and 500 female donkeys and very many servants, and that man was the greatest of all the men of the East. So you can just go up and down the whole Mediterranean coast and as far east as you want to go. That man had everything. Now, for some years I sold dairy feed. I got to associate with a whole lot of cattlemen, and I've seen some herds, but I've never seen a herd of cattle in all of Washington that had 7,000 head. Of course, these are sheep here, or even 3,000. Never saw a farm big enough, you know, had 3,000 of any kind of livestock. Camels in his case, 500 yoke of oxen. 500 yoke of oxen may represent 1,000 animals, as it was typical to have the double yoke. Maybe it was just 500 each in his own yoke. But even then, I never had a dairy in any of my accounts in all of the area that I worked where I sold dairy feed that had 500 animals. 300 was the biggest I had. But you know what? If you walk around every day, and you spend hours and hours and hours with dairymen out on their farms, and you watch a guy who's got 300 animals, one thing will really impress you. He's the busiest guy you ever met. It is 24/7. It never ends. So, this man, when it says, had very many servants, must have had very many servants. And also, in verse 4, so there's all the good physical stuff, his sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day. They would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And it came about when the days of feasting had completed their cycle that Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus, Job did continually. Now, what this is probably about, though again, we're not entirely sure, but probably what they are is birthday parties. He has 10 kids. He's going to have 10 birthdays every year. And apparently, in the course of these birthdays, they would have parties. It was pretty common in the ancient East to have parties. You know, ceremonial rejoicing that would go on for days on end, maybe a week or more. Now, you got 10 kids, I suppose you spend a week on each one, you know, on a big party board. That's a lot of time that you're going to spend in a year in those events. It's also opportunity
to get carried away and you're having such a good time. Very easy, brethren, especially when we're joyful, to forget what we're doing. I've heard many a joke that should have been told by Christians once they get kind of rollicking along, you know, in potluck and that sort of thing. Occasionally, you know, you just forget what you're about. And so Job, and this is the point now from the very beginning, is an individual who really loves his family. This is a family man. And he may be the busiest guy on the planet right now because he's the greatest man in all the East. He's got thousands and thousands of different breeds of animals that he's got to take care of. But he's on bended knee for his kids. He's concerned that they might just get carried away. Youthfulness will do that to you. And so, if you want to know what a righteous man is about, a righteous man, last word in the verse I think it is continually, is a man who is concerned about his grown kids who left home, and he is still praying for them. He's taking time, what apparently was a fair amount of time, to address before his God their spiritual condition. This is the mark of a righteous, blameless, upright man. Skipping down now to verse 14. A messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing, and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabians attacked and took them. They also slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." One of the first questions maybe you'll want to ask, and me too, when we get to heaven, is what was that fire of God? Well, it was a lightning strike. If so, it was the biggest bolt anybody ever heard of. Okay? You're talking about sheep, servants being consumed by this. You know, hard to imagine. Well, it was a lightning bolt set off a fire. You know, maybe so. But maybe, brethren, it was a direct act of God, a fire from God. I don't know. But it's blow number two. And in verse 17, while he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three bands and made a raid on the camels and took them, slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." He has suffered in a single day the invasion of both the Sabians and the Chaldeans. He has witnessed some sort of, you know, meteorological event, and he's lost all of this, when in verse 18, while the third one was still speaking, another came and said, "Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they died, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Now, brethren, don't think for a minute that back in the ancient days, you know, everybody lived in a tent. This was apparently a very significant structure. It had one really heavy roof and walls, and apparently a tornado of some kind struck, and when it did, it killed everybody in the house. A good, heavy home. It's demolished in this event. And now, you are desolate. On 20, Job arose, and he tore his robe, and he shaved his head, and he fell to the ground, and he worshipped. He did not fall to the ground to lament, "Woe is me." He did not fall to the ground to ask, you know, "Why me?" That'll come later. But this man, when he is struck with the heaviest blows that can be in this life, his initial response in the midst of the immediate knowledge of this thing. In other words, his natural reaction is to worship his God. I rather think, brethren, that would not be any of our first choice. It wouldn't be the natural thing that we would do. Not only why it is, but somehow I managed to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, I guess. But I've been in a number of life and death circumstances in my life. I've seen a number of accidents. I've seen a gunshot. I've seen stuff. And never yet have I thought to pray in the middle of the crisis. That was never yet my first response. My first response is to run around like the chicken with
head cut off, trying to deal with all these kinds of things. And then when the heat of battle is over, the paramedics and the fire department and all, have arrived, and they're taking things into their hands, then what? Well, it's easy, brethren, to just be amazed and thinking about all of this, but to fall down into worship. And that's just talking about other people. If it's you, you're the one. It's devastation to worship. That is a righteous person's natural and first response. So he worships, and he says in verse 21, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. That's amazing. That is just awesome. That is an example, as I've said before, it's an evidence for me that God would want to put this man out in front of the world. As he certainly does in the book. You know the story. For all the world, he will be God's proof before Satan himself in all of history that mankind will serve God even when it doesn't pay. Even when you can't get anything good out of it at all. Even when you suffered the worst kinds of losses. This is a man that understands his place in the food chain. This is a man that understands his relationship with his God. This is a man who gets that if he's had anything in this life, then it came from the hand of God. And this is a man who understands then that if it's taken away from him, that is God's decision to make. Now, I've been here 3 years. I have senior moments about 8 times a day, and so, pardon me if I've told you this story before. It's one of my all-time favorite preacher's illustrations, but the story goes about a guy in Texas, and he's a farmer, and there is an actual plague of locusts comes in on his farm, and it just decimates his whole crop. They eat that thing down to the ground, okay? So all the farmers are commiserating. They've all had their losses, too, and terrible it is, all the worry and everything that goes on. Supposedly, this man, I don't know if it's made up or not, supposedly this guy said, well, if God wants to pasture his grasshoppers on his land, then I guess he can. Now, isn't that Job's attitude? Whose land is it? It's God's land. Whose grasshoppers are they? God's grasshoppers. It's his pasture land. He can do what he wants with it. Now, brother, when you hear that, and that's a response we all have. And we should. But that was Job's natural response when it actually happened, and it included the deaths of all 10 of his children. Oh, that's a man who understands that God's in charge. Now, brethren, he's going to explore human suffering to its bottommost depth. He'll see the floor of the Marianas Trench on this question before it's all over. But that's how he started. And then, of course, came the terrible test where Satan afflicts then his flesh as well. In verse 7, Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. You know the story. I'm skipping it. He smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. He took a potsherd to scrape himself, broken piece of pottery, while he was sitting among the ashes. And then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity?" Now, before we go any farther, do you note that she recognized from the end of chapter 1 that that's what he was doing? He was a man of integrity. He'd always said he believed in God. He'd always thanked God for everything that he had. But you don't know how you really feel about it until God then takes it away. And this woman was pretty close to all this. They're her children too. She's given up her integrity. She's turned her back on her God. She's in it for what she can get. Do you still maintain your integrity here? You bet he does. Curse God and die, she suggests, but in verse 10 he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now, friend, that is hard to do. I mean, hard to do. And for those of us who have been faithful Christians for decades, it's still hard to do. When your legs are cut out from under you with the death of a child or a maid or a parent or whatever, you know, it's just so hard. But Job set the standard, and if he can do it, then we can do it. Not only academically to thank God, yes, I understand he gave me all these things, but to be grateful to God when they are removed from us as well, and to commit no sin in their loss. Such a standard this man sets. In chapter 3, if your Bible is arranged like mine, the verses are really very short, so don't be frightened by 11 verses here. In chapter 3, afterward, Job opened his mouth and he cursed the day of his birth. And he said, "Let the day perish on which I was to be born, and the night which said a boy is conceived. May that day be darkness. Let not God above care for it, nor light shine on it. Let darkness and black gloom claim it. Let a cloud settle on it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that night, let darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful shout enter it. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are prepared to rouse Leviathan. Let the stars of its twilight be darkened. Let it wait for light, but have none. Let it not see the breaking dawn, because it did not shut the opening of my mother's womb or hide trouble from my eyes. Why did I not die at birth, come forth from the womb, and expire?" Now, brethren, is that sin? I don't think so. It is okay to lament your losses. It is certainly all right. God built this emotion into us to hurt when those we love leave us. Grief is not a sin. And to say, "I wish I had never been born," is not a sin. It is a recognition for some people of a fact, because now what was most precious is gone. They see no reason to live. They can see no value in all that has gone before. That is, I think, a right and proper response. It is grief. When you hear that, don't rebuke that. Wait and see where it will lead the sufferer. Now skip to chapter 6. Let me look at verse 8. Job says, "Oh, that my request might come to pass, and that God would grant my longing. Would that God were willing to crush me, that he would loose his hand and cut me off." What did he ask for? Death. "But it is still my consolation, and I rejoice in unsparing pain, that I have not denied the words of the Holy One." In all of this, brethren, it is okay even to long for death. We just finished Ecclesiastes. What's the last chapter about? The days when you come in your old age that you can find no pleasure in. When Solomon said those days come, he did not say it was a sin for you to recognize them for what they are. Those days come for most of us. And to desire then to be free from that suffering, to accept the life that you have had as a gift from God, and to be willing to surrender it now and go to your reward, is not a sin. This man is not crying out against his God, but he is in the depths of agony, and he's expressing his grief in an acceptable manner. Chapter 10 in the first 7 verses. "I loathe my own life. I will give full vent to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend with me. Is it right for you indeed to oppress, to reject the labor of your hands, to look favorably on the schemes of the wicked? Have you eyes of flesh? Or do you see as a man sees? Are your days as the days of mortal man? Or your years as man's years? That you should seek for my guilt and search after my sin? According to your knowledge, I am indeed not guilty. Yet, there's no deliverance from your hand. Now, brothers, this is a man crying out for help. This is not a man who's accusing God. Read those words carefully. He's just questioning. I don't get it. And brothers, to this day, people don't get it. It's all right to not get it. God will help you to understand it in due time. When circumstances like these befall people, it is disorienting. You don't understand. All he's doing is crying out for that understanding. Now in chapter 12, 13, and we'll take time to read all of this, though it is relatively short. He says, with him are wisdom and might. To him belong counsel and understanding. Behold, he tears down and it cannot be rebuilt. He imprisons a man and there can be no relief. And you just scan the rest of those verses. What is he doing? He is praising God. And he sees God's awesome power. His control of all the nations and all things. He stands in awe of the way God controls this earth. But what he is doing is praising God for all these things. Some of them, brethren, involve the deaths of tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of people in the fall of these nations in those brutal and bloody days. But he knows how to praise his God. We'll close our lesson tonight with chapter 19, verses 25 and following. 19, 25 to the end of the chapter. As for me, I know that my Redeemer lives. And at the last, he will take his stand on the earth. Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I shall see God, whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes shall see, and not another. My heart faints within me. If you say, how shall we persecute him, and what pretext for a case against him can we find, that him is himself, then be afraid of the sword for yourselves. For wrath brings the punishment of the sword, so that you may know that there is judgment. Brother, we've been afflicted now since the 70s with a false doctrine that we refer to by many names, but I prefer realized eschatology. Realized eschatology teaches that the resurrection will never happen. Very boldly, I've heard them say time and again, why there's no such thing in all the Bible as any kind of a promise of a resurrection of physical bodies out of the grave. They think that the resurrection verses in the New Testament are talking about the renewal of a covenant. So they like to refer to themselves sometimes as covenant eschatologists or covenant last things, people. So their idea is that the Bible never promises that there will ever be a resurrection of the dead, physical bodies coming out of the tomb. If I'm right, and Job is the first Bible author who lived before Moses, and who has then the blessing and honor of writing the first ever Bible book, in the midst of this giant treatise about loss and suffering, and how you should relate to God, just about dead center in 14 chapters, in chapter 19, what did that man just say? He said, I'm coming back from the dead. He said, though my skin is gone, yet in the flesh I'll see him again. That's resurrection, brethren.
promised in the earliest book in all the Bible.
What was this man all about?
This was about a man who would not sin with his mouth. Righteous, blameless, upright, feared God. And when he was really put to the test as the standard for all of mankind by Satan himself in a direct attack, he did not sin. Oh my, how he suffered. And then set the standard for us. Brethren, praise God in it all. And then know you're coming back in resurrection to face judgment. Do not sin with your mouths as his miserable comforters of a friend, three of them, you know, did. Next week, more on this great man's life.
Thank you for a couple of extra minutes. As always, we offer this invitation if we can be of help to you becoming a Christian, solving some problem, answering a Bible question. Please just come forward, speak with me, and we'll help any way we can as we sing this final song.